Sunday, September 13th, 3.5 months to go, start a new year. It's like 2020 didn't exist, right? It's kind of a unique year. All right, let's bring ourselves up to speed with what we're doing in our Sunday morning and our Sunday night classes. We're reading through the Bible, obviously, this year. And we are in the book of Ezekiel in their reading. If you look at, If you look at our reading through the 13th, we're actually supposed to finish through chapter 48. So last week on the 6th, we made it through chapter 31 in our review. That's here. So we've got about 17 chapters to do this morning and this evening. Oh, what do we do there? All right, let's try this. That's all a Wi-Fi thing. Let's try this. My apologies, we'll start that in a second. Oh, it's doing that on everything. All right, let me see if we've got... that's right. Technology is great when it works. Technology is great when it works. So let's turn this off. And now let's turn it back on. You guys just didn't have your special glasses. There we go. Let's hope it stays that way.
Believe it or not, that's a master fix. Turn it off.
Turn it on, that's it. Turn off, turn it on. All right, so let's go back to where we were. Okay, so we were looking at our daily Bible reading schedule. There we go. All right, so last week we finished summarizing through chapter 31. We're going to take up with 32, and by the end of the day in our evening session, we'll finish through chapter 48. So we're going to start with chapter 32 in just a moment. Let's have a word of prayer before we get started, and then we'll get into our review. Our Heavenly Father, we're thankful for this day, thankful for every blessing of life, thankful for the opportunity to be here, thankful for those who are here, mindful of those who could not be here for whatever reason, physical or spiritual. We hope and pray that we can do whatever we can to encourage and to help, to reach out to others. We're mindful of so many things going on in the lives of our friends, our family, and extended connections in and out of the kingdom of God. We hope and pray that we'll be able to be your people in such a way that we can be useful to represent who you are and what you are like, and encourage others to be as much like you as they possibly can. We pray that you'll be with us as we go through this study at this time, so that we will not only learn more about you, but that we will love you in the process and want to serve you better every day. We ask all of this in the name of your Son, the Christ. Amen. All right, so one of two things. You can follow along what we're doing on the screen, but you can also look in your Bibles, starting with chapter 32 of Ezekiel, and we'll continue. So while we're getting to the right place, just a brief recap of who Ezekiel is, when Ezekiel lived. Ezekiel lived in the period of captivity. Prophets are designated as either being a before, during, or after captivity prophet, and he is one of two prophets who is exclusively in the middle of captivity. The other one's Daniel, that we get into next. So here's where we left off last time in the text, chapter 31. So we're ready for chapter 32. So what's his job? His job is to tell the children of Israel that even though they're in captivity in fulfillment of prophecy, and that they're going to be in captivity for 70 years, that things are not going to get any better. They're going to get worse for a while. And so the mindset at the beginning of the period of captivity was that as long as the temple still stood, they were fine. And the reason why they had so much faith in the temple was they emphasized too much on physical aspects of God's blessings as opposed to spiritual aspects. They had the land, and Moses prophesied, if you're not faithful to God, God can take you out of the land. God brought you into the land. God can take you out of the land. You've never heard a parent say this. I brought you into this world. I can take you out. No parents ever said that. No, of course not. But in effect, that's what God in principle said. I brought you here. I can remove you from here. Now, he didn't say it in a fit of anger. He said it based upon their faithfulness. It's because I loved you, I brought you here. When you stop loving me, I will take you away from here. And that's in effect what happened. The northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And so Ezekiel has the challenging task of telling people, yes, God still loves you, but you're not in the land anymore. And you're thinking, how could that be? And yes, God still loves you. And though the temple's still standing for now, the temple will be destroyed and Jerusalem will be destroyed. So if you've placed your faith in the temple and in the city of Jerusalem rather than the God who told you to build those things to his honor and his glory, then your faith is misplaced. And so for a while, the children of Israel in captivity, primarily from the southern kingdom of Judah at this time, the northern kingdom was already taken into captivity, they're a little bit frustrated. You know, we don't see that this is going to happen. And when it does happen, it's like hope is gone. Temple gone, Jerusalem gone, hope is gone. Well, God's not gone. God's not dwelling in the holy place of the temple anymore, but God's still in control. And that's one of the things we're going to emphasize when we go in our worship period this morning, studying about Daniel, is that God rules, not men. God's always in control. We are rarely in control. So that's important to understand. All right, so let's jump into where we were. We'll just take up at the last chapter we left off last time, chapter 31. It's prophecies against the land of Egypt. If you go through the book of Isaiah and through the book of Jeremiah and now in the book of Ezekiel, you'll see that there are several prophecies made not only against their respective kingdoms, that is Israel in the north and Judah in the south, but about the kingdoms surrounding them. So there are going to be judgments against Egypt, against Philistia, against Tyre, against Moab, against Edom, against Syria, against Assyria, against Babylon. All of those nations are going to be included in judgments that God's going to pronounce by means of the prophets. Well, why? Well, most of them had adverse connections with the nation of Israel in the north and Judah in the south. They were constantly oppressing them. They were influencing them to be involved in idol worship and pagan worship that was part and parcel of the religious and cultural system of those nations. And so, you know, they weren't a good influence. And Israel and Judah sometimes capitulated to that influence. They would be engaged in worshiping other gods. Just read through the book of Judges and you'll see how that influence from other nations impacted that. So in this chapter, there's a judgment against Egypt. They were depicted as a great fruitful tree at one time, but they're not there anymore. And so don't think too highly of yourself, Egypt. God will bring you down. In fact, that's one of the things that's brought out in the book of Daniel repeatedly. God rules in the affairs of individuals. God rules in the affairs of individual nations and all nations. And that's a tough lesson to know. All right, so chapter 32, where we're taking up more judgments, more prophecies against the nation of Egypt. Remember, they had been in captivity in the nation of Egypt in times past, but circumstances had changed, and they were often relying on Egypt as a means of support to help them against other nations. Recently, in 609 BC, Pharaoh Necho had defeated King Josiah, the last of the righteous kings. And after that, things went really bad from the standpoint of kings in Judah. There wasn't a righteous king after that. And within 3 years of that defeat and after his death, the southern kingdom is going to be taken into Babylonian captivity. But they're still hoping that Egypt's going to help them. Now, that's crazy. Egypt killed one of their kings, and Egypt imposed one of his sons as a ruler and kind of made him a puppet king, and they're still depending on him to fight against the Babylonians. It's just a weird, strange thing about what's going on. So Egypt is going to be the subject of judgment, especially Pharaoh, who, of course, is like king in Egypt. So Pharaoh is a title, not just a name. So they are going to be judged. Pharaoh's described as being like a young lion. Well, what are young lions? Well, they're wanting to prove who they are. They're wanting to assert some sense of authority. They're wanting to demonstrate that they're the ones in control and so forth. And so that image is used to depict him. And God says, in effect, well, yeah, that's kind of what you are. It's kind of in your DNA to be a king and a pharaoh and a military leader. But you're going to be punished because of what you've done to others. And so you will also be judged. Notice when we get into point three in the outline, Babylon is described as being the executioner of Egypt. Now, tables are being turned. One of the unique things in studying the history of any particular area of the world at any particular time is understanding the dynamic of respective kingdoms. Kingdoms, nations are always jockeying for power. Tell me whether or not that's going on in the world today. Yeah, all the time. And so if you look at all kinds of stuff in the news on a regular basis, people are concerned about Sino-Soviet relations, they're concerned about China's connection with people in the Eastern Rim and in Africa and other places and also in South America. There's always an issue about what is this country doing to impact this country here and why are they doing that? What's their advantage? Is it military? Is it political? Is it financial? And that dynamic is always going on. And it's going on here. And so Babylon isn't the ascendant nation yet, but they're about to be. And they're the ones who are going to put Egypt in their place, and they're the ones who are going to take the southern kingdom into captivity. So she's going to come and remove all the pomp of Egypt. Egypt's going to be left desolate, not going to be filled with riches, and she's going to be subjected, as the southern kingdom of Judah is, to the influence and the power of Babylon. And that's going to continue for a while until we get to the next nation that's going to be in control, Medes and the Persians. We'll learn more about that as we get into Daniel. The latter part of the chapter is a lament. Remember, Jeremiah was filled with lamentations, usually associated with being the author of Lamentations. And this one is directed not just at Pharaoh and the nation of Egypt, but all those people who placed their trust in them. And so here's the thing. When something that you trust in, or someone that you trust in, falters, fails, or goes away, then there's a tendency for people to lose faith. So if your faith isn't a thing, like the southern kingdom had faith in the temple, when the temple was gone, their faith weakened. If your faith is in a nation, in a leader, in anybody else, if something happens to them that they turn against you, they disappoint you, they don't live up to what you anticipated and so forth, then it weakens your faith. So anytime you have your strength and the assumed help and care of something else or someone else, and it doesn't do what you want it to do, then it destroys you psychologically, or it can destroy you psychologically. So here's the point. All of these other nations are going to be in the same boat that Egypt is when Egypt, whom they relied on, falls. And that's exactly what you see in the book of Revelation. In the book of Revelation, when Babylon, referring to the great harlot that sat upon the hills and so forth, that everybody worshipped and everybody was involved in being in bed with, physically as well as spiritually and financially, when Babylon the great whore is depicted as falling, all the other nations were weeping. We are losing something. So it's not because of her, it's because of what they lose when she is going to be destroyed. And so that's what happens many times. So these nations are all in the same boat, the same pit together. So the other nations are also mentioned in the subject of prophecy because they're tied in some way to Egypt. When the fortunes of a nation upon whom other nations depend, when they fail, other nations are adversely affected as well. That's going on today. It's been going on since man has existed. All right, chapter 33. We mentioned this before, that there is an image that's applied to Ezekiel, and that is of being a watchman. Well, what's the job of a watchman? It's somebody who's on the parapets, on the towers, on the in battlements of a strengthened city, a fortress-like city in its walls. And their job is to watch to see what's coming from the distance. All right, so there's no modern means of telecommunications. There's none of that stuff going on. So you've got to watch. You know, people who are on ships, you know, they have lots of modern means of technology today to find out what's going on around them and to detect others. But the old-style way was, guy goes up in the crow's nest, and he looks out on the horizon, and he looks to see ships with enemy flags, and says, enemy ship approaching, and his job is to tell everybody. Well, the job of the watchman, and that's Ezekiel's task, his job description here, is to watch what's coming. Only it's not just physically, it's also spiritually. And so if God says this is coming spiritually, and it's not something that he sees with his own eyes, that God reveals it because God sees it and says you need to pass this along to others, then it was his job to tell others. All right, it's a job of many people in different aspects of life today and professions to warn people of something that they see in danger, that brings people into a realm of danger. You go to your doctor, and your doctor sees something's bad going on in your life, and he doesn't tell you, he's not doing his job. If he's suspicious of things that are going on in the home life of others because of a child's brought in and there's something suspicious, then his job is to notify the authorized officials to say, hey, We suspect something's going on negatively in this family, in this house, whatever. School system's the same way. You see something that's going on, and you're concerned about it, and you're not sure you're supposed to say something. You've got to be judicious in that. You don't want to bring false charges against anybody, but that's the job of a watchman that he's supposed to do. So, what's he supposed to do? He's a lookout. He's looking for anybody who's invading physically and or spiritually, and both of those things are going to come to fore. So if you read through the chapter, you're going to see all that's going to be brought out. If you don't do your duty, then you're going to be held responsible. Hey, you saw this coming and you didn't tell anybody. Why did that happen? Again, just look through, you know, news reports for the last 20, 30, 40 years, however, and you're going to find people being brought up in charges because they knew something was going on and they didn't pass that information along to the authorities that should have received notice of that. Same thing here, only this is a spiritual thing. So if you tell what's going on and people don't listen, that's not your fault. But if you don't tell people what's going on, obviously, they'll have an opportunity to listen because you didn't tell them. Well, that's not only your fault, but it's going to impact what's going to happen in the lives of others. So it's a pretty serious responsibility, spiritually and physically. All right, so here in this section, we're way into the book of Ezekiel, but Ezekiel is tasked with the most onerous of responsibilities in telling the people who are in captivity, who have been in captivity for almost 20 years, if they've been there from the beginning, that the city of Jerusalem not only was surrounded and captured 20 years ago, but now it's gone. It's gone. And the temple is gone. Now they have already looted the treasures of the temple and the king's houses. They've already brought those things to Babylon. And we're going to see that come into play when we get into the book of Daniel in our worship period this morning. And so they've already known that the Babylonians are in control of the city, but it's still there. And they already know that the temple was looted and a lot of the goods from the temple are brought to Babylon, but it's still there. And so as long as the city still stood and the temple still stood, there was an iota of hope left. And now Ezekiel's going to tell them it's not there anymore. The city is destroyed. The temple is destroyed. Where is your faith now? And it's after this that they are just absolutely so overwhelmed and thinking, well, that's it. You know, who's going to help us now? City gone, temple gone. Where's our hope? And therein lies the problem. Absent the city, absent the temple, they should have still had faith and hope in God. But because they were placing their faith and hope in physical things rather than spiritual things, their hope and their faith was dashed. And so that had to be rebuilt. And God, of course, tells them, I'm going to restore you and I am going to bring you back. There will be another Jerusalem rebuilt. There will be another temple rebuilt. But they don't see that. The first one's gone, city and temple, and that was the source of their faith in large measure. Now, we're not saying everybody was that way, but too many people were. That's why when Jeremiah was prophesying, the people would constantly say, we don't care what you say. You see that? And all they can do is point to the temple. Whatever you're saying is dumb, worthless, stupid, because God's still there on the house. Now, they didn't say that literally, but that's the way they treated Jeremiah. And that's the way they treated his prophecies. All right, so it's finally going to happen. He's been telling him it's going to happen. It's going to happen, it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And it happened. So imagine this. Let's jump into the future a few hundred years. So Ezekiel's in the middle of captivity from 606 to 736. That's the period of captivity, 70 years. And so you jump at the end of the captivity and go another half a millennium forward, and you're in the time of Christ. And guess what Jesus gets in trouble for doing? And guess what Stephen gets in trouble for doing? The temple's going to be destroyed. We've heard that before. And we didn't buy into it, and it happened. We ain't buying into that again. All right? We're not going to let, that's not going to happen again. This is no way. And so Jesus was accused of speaking against the temple. Mr. Jeremiah did that, and it ended up being true. Mr. Ezekiel did that, and it ended up being true. But it can't happen again. That's what they assumed. And so when Stephen is brought on trial, he's accused of speaking against Moses, against the law, against the temple. Same stuff. We don't want to hear that. This temple's been rebuilt. Remember when Jesus said, I will destroy this temple and build it up in 3 days? He's referring to his body, his physical body, the physical resurrection. But when the Jews heard it, all they could think about was the temple. The one that was rebuilt during the period of restoration wasn't the greatest, but for the last 40 plus years during Herod's reign, It did nothing but beautify it and make it an incredible building. It was just known throughout the world. People have talked about it, and you read the writings of historians. They said coming upon the temple in Jerusalem in the last days of his existence, in the end of the period before the Christ and during the time of the Christ, it was gleaming marble and gold everywhere, and it was blinding in the sun if you saw that. It was just absolutely impressive. And yet Jesus, before he died and before he was betrayed, as he's on the way out of Jerusalem, going up to Bethany in the Mount of Olives, going up in ascent, looking back, and the disciples said, "Behold, what manner of buildings these are." They were just blown away because of the magnificent structure that the temple was now after and during the course of Herod's rebuilding project. And Jesus said, not one stone is going to remain upon another. And so Jesus got into all kinds of trouble because we don't want to hear that again. We've suffered that loss once. No way is it going to happen again. That's what they thought. But it was going to happen again. The problem is, 2,000 years later, no temple's been rebuilt. Still not there. Not going to happen. There'll be a whole lot of wars going on before anything like that happens. So Ezekiel is now tasked with telling them the first time. Jeremiah said, you're going into captivity. Don't put your faith in the temple. And Ezekiel's tasked with telling them, it's gone. Something that is so much the focal point of a person's faith and a person's reason for living, to take it away, you can just imagine how horrible that is. The loss of a loved one, something going on in your own life, loss of jobs, loss of fortune. People have lost lives and family members and everything they own in the fires out west. That's just absolutely devastating. But this is the source of their faith, not just their physical existence. And so he's not going to be the most loved guy. So he's going to be vindicated because it happens. So Ezekiel is not really accepted by the Jews any more than Jeremiah was, any more than Isaiah was. You're telling stuff bad about us. Who wants to hear bad news all the time? You get up in the morning, you turn on the news, you listen to something online, and it says, this is going down, 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 this is going bad, 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 and you click, I don't want to hear it anymore. You're the same way today. And it doesn't have to be spiritual news. It could be any kind of news. I'm tired of that garbage. I don't want to hear it anymore. And so they didn't like that. And so, they were going to not be happy when they heard his message. All right, chapter 34. This, we mentioned earlier that the word shepherd that's used in the New Testament and the Old Testament is used physically, and it's also used spiritually. It's used physically with reference to shepherds who keep literal sheep and their responsibility to the sheep. But the word shepherd is also used with reference to leaders of any kind. In politics, in religion, in economy, in business, whatever it is, they're shepherds, they're leaders, they're guiding, they're supposed to be providing for and sustaining the people for whom they are responsible. So in this chapter, the shepherds are taken to task, and it compares, obviously, what a physical shepherd does to take care of physical sheep, and what a spiritual business or political or economic shepherd does in taking care of its respective areas of concern. And so they're being spoken against. Why? Because a lot of them lied. Now here's what's weird. A shepherd can't lie to a sheep. Literally a physical shepherd can't lie to a sheep. He can do things that aren't good for them. He can refuse to feed them. That's not his job. He can refuse to protect them. That's not his job. But you can't lie to a sheep because they don't perceive that. They don't grasp that. But these shepherds are feeding their sheep with falsehoods. So rather than giving them something that they need, they're withholding what they need from them. And then they're telling them lies. And so the shepherds are going to get into trouble. And so if you read through this review, that's what you're going to see repeatedly. That includes all the three P's, the princes, the prophets, the priests. The princes refers to anybody that's in any kind of administrative role, any kind of rule over others, the kings and everybody in their court, all the administrators and so forth, whatever governors, that's all princes. That's just generally referring to them. And the prophets and the priests, again, the spiritual division. And they have been accused of not healing people who are sick. You see this in Jeremiah and in the same principles brought out here. They're accused of healing the sick slightly. Well, that's a weird expression. What's it mean? It means you haven't really taken care of the problem. You haven't addressed, you put a Band-Aid on something that requires a whole lot more care than that. And so Jeremiah took him to task. And Ezekiel takes him to task. Read Jeremiah 23. That whole chapter is about Jeremiah challenging the religious leaders who haven't been doing what they're supposed to be doing. So because of that, God's against these leaders. If you are not a responsible leader in the context of what's going on in prophets, and then God's going to hold you accountable. The whole notion of leaders is to lead, and to lead in such a way that people not only follow them, but they follow them because it's a good thing to do. When you lead in a bad way, as Jeroboam did when the kingdom divided, instituting a false system of worship, then you lead people in a bad way. So leaders are responsible not only for themselves and their decisions, but for the impact that happens on others. So what's going to happen? God says, you're not going to take care of my people, I will. And that's a thing that's repeated many times in Ezekiel. You haven't stood up for me, so I need to stand up for me. Your job description as a leader is to lead people to be what I want them to be, not what you want them to be, and to honor and glorify me and not to honor and glorify you. And if you don't do that, then not only will you be punished, then I am tasked with the responsibility of doing what you failed to do. And so get out of the way, let me do my job. That's, you know, kind of a coarse way of saying it, but in effect, that's what God's going to say. I will care for them. So in this context, he promises a shepherd. And you will see this repeatedly in the Old Testament text, that sometimes David is referred to as a coming shepherd. Well, David's long since dead by this time. So we are, you know, 500 plus years before the time of Christ, and David lived another 500 years roughly, just using rough figures here before that. So David's gone. And so the restoration of David as a shepherd gives people a false sense of hope in thinking we're going to have another David-like king who's going to whoop up on all our enemies and going to demand respect from the nations of the world, and we're going to be in fine standing before the nations, and we'll have everything that we want. Only the prophecies about a coming shepherd that is David is referring to David's leadership and his shepherd skills. He was literally a shepherd, and it's spiritualized. And so the tabernacle of David that's going to be restored is talking about spiritual things are going to happen. And the shepherd that's going to come to be like David is going to be the spiritual things that are going to happen. So the very first verse of the first book in the New Testament, Matthew 1:1 says, this is the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David. There's the shepherd connection. There's the king connection. There's the tabernacle being rebuilt spiritually connection, as well as the son of Abraham. There's the covenant promise connection. And so that's ultimately going to come. So God's going to bring a shepherd that's going to do spiritually what these leaders were failing to do at this time. All right. So, and they're going to be abundantly fruitful when that happens. All right, chapter 35 is a prophecy against Mount Seir. And you might think, well, why are you prophesying against a mountain? That doesn't make any sense. But Mount Seir was the stronghold of the nation of Edom, the nation that is descended from Esau. Remember that Jacob and Esau were brothers and sons of Isaac, and Jacob is the one who's going to receive the blessing because Esau didn't consider it worth anything. And Jacob later it becomes known as Israel, and the tribes of Israel are the 12 sons of Jacob. And so this is an uncle way up the line to the Jews multiple generations back. And so there had been a tendency for tension to exist from that point forward. Remember, after he got the blessing, and he went, and his brother went into his father, and he found out that the blessing already been given. Esau, you know, please, don't you have some other blessing to give me? But the laws of primogeniture, which means the laws of the firstborn inheritance, was such that the firstborn gets everything, and he gave it to Jacob, not knowing it wasn't Esau. So there wasn't another firstborn blessing. I've given that away. So I'm a little bit ticked here. And so Jacob goes away, and for 20 years he's gone. And when he comes back, he's filled with apprehension about how is Esau going to treat him. So he sends all of his flocks and all of his entourage in front of him. And what's all this? Oh, these are all the things I've been blessed with when I've been gone. And he's very, very deferential to Esau when he comes back. So there's an element of tension that exists literally between the two brothers 20 years later. And that tension continues by means of what happens in their descendants, their nations, respective nations going forward. So when the children of Israel come out of captivity in the land of Egypt and they're heading towards the land of Canaan, one of the nations that didn't treat them very well was the nation of Edom. So at this time, Edom, and we're going to see this specifically in Obadiah, the only single chapter book in the Old Testament. Obadiah prophesies against Edom. You are in Mount Seir where eagles fly, and you act like nobody can come near you because you're in an exalted position physically, literally in the mountains. He says, but God can bring you down. And so in this context, the descendants of Esau, the Edomites, are spoken against because they were just absolutely happy that Judah got their comeuppance. They're in captivity, they're being dominated, they're taken away, and we're just excited about that. We are okay that you got whooped up on, all right? And so prophecies are going to be mentioned against them. Again, that's going to be brought out again in the book of Obadiah. And so because of their hatred and their rejoicing that other people are going to be punished, God's going to say, well, that's not really the best attitude. I'm going to pause for a second here. And I don't want to make this piece of social commentary, but when somebody does something bad, the tendency is, good, you deserve that. I got it. You know, you did something bad, you should be punished. But let's be careful about how we rejoice in that. If somebody does something bad, it's not just a mistake that they made, but they committed some kind of sin against God or against people created in God's image, that's sad. And there's a sense in which it's okay to be thankful that they're going to be punished, but let's not be overly exalting in that. You know, let's not mock them and kick them and beat them. And remember, they're still human beings, even though they've done something wrong. And so God wants us to be forgiving to others, even when they act like they're not worthy of forgiveness. And they do things that we might think are unforgivable. And so part of the problem here is, okay, you got your comeuppance, you deserve that, but don't relish that. Don't glory in that. Don't act like, you know, your whole existence is made better because of that. I did not do that. All right. So that means lots of things. It means you can't see the screen. That means the internet went out, and whoever's watching us out in the internet world can't see us either. And the only thing that's staying alive is the screen of my laptop. All right. I don't know if that's going to happen or come back again, but we'll continue. Let me just say you guys all look good in the dark. Bad joke. Bad joke. Bad joke. All right. So and the audio recording is still going, so we'll have that up later to do that. So the next chapter is chapter 36, and it's all talking about what's going to happen when Israel is going to be restored. And so Israel is going to be restored later at the end of the 7 years of captivity, 70 years of captivity. So it hasn't happened yet. So even after the final nail in the coffin, you know, comes out, and that the temple is destroyed and the city of Jerusalem is destroyed, there's still hope after that. So the loss of what you had your hope in before doesn't mean there's no hope at all. That stuff can be rebuilt, but more importantly, you need to make sure you have your hope in God. And so God promises them, you will once again return to a privileged state. May not be as great as you were, but you're going to be better than you are now. Israel once again would be a prosperous nation. Their nations aren't going to hold them in derision anymore because they've returned to something like what they used to be. They're going to be given a new heart. They're going to be given a new spirit. Jeremiah said they're going to be given a new covenant, Jeremiah chapter 31. Ezekiel refers to that. And you're not going to be scattered anymore. And so in the midst of what looks like absolute incredible doom and despair, he says there's hope on the other side of the temple being destroyed. There's hope on the other side of the city of Jerusalem destroyed. And so the people are going to be returned finally to their homeland, but you still have to go through these 70 years of punishment. So what was desolate in the land of Judah is going to be fruitful once again. So again, things get really, really, really bleak, and their hope is dashed because it was placed in the wrong thing. And Ezekiel says, that was my job to tell you this is what's going to happen, but things will get better later. So that's going to have to happen later. All right, chapter 37, and we focused on this last time in our lesson Sunday morning, and that's where Ezekiel spoke about the Valley of Dry Bones. And so I won't repeat that other than to say the Valley of Dry Bones represented just heaps of bones. And they came together to form skeletons. And they came together with sinew and flesh to form bodies. And skin came upon them. But they're still dead. And so God had asked Ezekiel the question, can these bones live again? And Ezekiel says, I don't know, you know. And God makes them alive again. And they're not only brought back together as intact skeletons and intact bodies and live bodies, but they are described as being an army for the Lord. So God restores them and does all these things for his honor and glory. Well, that's one vision. But the second vision that's brought out in the book, and we didn't focus on this last week, is that there are two sticks that he sees. And they're described as being the stick of Joseph and Ephraim, the two sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. They're two sons of Joseph come back together. And it represents the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom that had been separated. And so the northern kingdom went into captivity 116 years before the southern kingdom did. And then when the southern kingdom went into captivity, it's like all hope's gone. Northern kingdom gone, southern kingdom gone. And Ezekiel says, no, they are going to come back together. And so if you read through the text when you get an opportunity, he says, I'm going to make them one nation again. No longer division between southern and northern, northern and southern. They're going to be one nation again. So there's another indication of hope. Dead bones come back to life. Two kingdoms that have been separated and act like they're never going to be together again and at odds with each other on many occasions, they're going to be brought together and God's going to bless them. All right, still have a few more minutes. We'll look at chapter 38. This chapter are mentioned in this chapter are Gog and Magog. And you're saying, well, wait a minute, this has got a Revelation kind of feel to it. Just a reminder, some of the visions that we see in Ezekiel and Daniel and Zechariah are very much like some of the visions that we see in the context of the book of Revelation. And so the identification of what they stand for and represent it hasn't been fully explained in the context. The point is they refer to some sense of power, some sense of rule that's going to come in and going to shake things up from the standpoint of what's going on in world empires. So their exact identification isn't given. And so it may have been applied to some ruler who's not specified, not identified. Like Pharaoh was the title of the rulers of Egypt, and other nations had kings that had unique titles. And so it may have been a king of some land north of Israel. Often their judgment came from the north simply because of the physical passageways that made that easy. And so it's talking about a time when they're going to rule and the time when they're going to be punished. So after the time that the Jews return to Canaan, this Gog, whoever it is, and his armies are going to come against them. They're going to battle them. Seems to be the thought in mind that Israel is going to be weakened because of their return from captivity, but they're going to be victorious. So here's the point. Once you have gone through this period of trial and captivity, you will be strengthened even though it looks like you're decimated, and you will be able to stand against any enemies. And so that's a message that was intended to give hope to them. Last part of the chapter, chapter 38, let's stop after this. In verse 17 and following tells us that prophets spoke about this in Israel's history, that they're going to accomplish a great victory in the future after the period of restoration. It also tells us that God allowed these things in order to cleanse Israel from their former bad reputation. So their reputation was that they just whooped on everybody in the past and dominated everybody. Remember, during the period of restoration, that's the reputation that people had. We can't let these people rebuild. They're going to do what they did before. They just were mean and nasty to everybody around them. And so they're trying to rebuild this reputation. So to defeat this enemy that's defeated, that's mentioned here, is going to be a plus for them. All right. We've got about 6 minutes left. We've got chapter 39 that we're about to start. We'll start that tonight, and then we'll continue. So our goal is to get through another 8 or 9 chapters tonight, get through chapter 48. So because we are all in the dark, literally, maybe spiritually, at this point, no, I'm just kidding. Let's stop and take a break, and we'll resume when we can. And hopefully, something better will happen. Maybe not.